Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, content manager at the Institute, and in this podcast, we will be looking at news from the week up to the 4th of November 2019. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story, Kate, asks if management shortfalls risk disengaging nurses. Research from specialist recruitment consultancy WR Health found that committed healthcare professionals lack confidence in management, with just 40% saying their manager motivated them to give their best every day and only 39% saying they receive regular feedback on their performance. The survey of 16,670 employees included registered nurses, clinical lead and advanced nurse practitioners, and they found that while respondents were overwhelmingly proud to work within their industry and considered their work to be an important part of their life, just 43% said they had confidence in their leadership team. Commenting on the findings, Lewis Richards, director of WR Health, said, "The majority of the job seekers we work with are seeking a more favourable working environment and opportunities for professional advancement. At a time when skills shortages are well documented across the sector, if you don't provide what your employees desire and deserve, another employer certainly will." Kate, what can leaders do to provide a favourable working environment and opportunities for professional advancement?
Well, before addressing that part of your question, Rod, I'd like to comment on people being so critical of their managers. I don't think managers come to work not wanting to do a good job. And is it unrealistic to expect to be motivated every day by your manager to give your very best? Or are we being slightly unrealistic? And are those people who are managed, are they thinking, how can I help my manager manage me? How can I help my manager motivate me? If I want feedback on performance, am I receptive to it or am I defensive? I think what it also shows is how much time managing staff well takes up. And I think particularly in this industry, where they'll have their own clinical practice and their own patients, their own work to do, maybe there's just not enough time to give to the people around them. But certainly, as our research New Year, New Job showed earlier this year, people of all age groups want training. They want to develop, I think, far more than we fully understand and certainly we appreciate. So getting to know the people you work with, we say it so often, don't we? What do they want? What makes them want to come to work? How, as a manager, you can make it a bit easier and a bit better for them has to be where we start.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our next story suggests that rhetoric masks lack of progress on gender diversity in finance. This is research from the Financial Conduct Authority, which shows that the number of women in senior roles in financial services firms in Britain has flatlined since 2005, despite diversity rhetoric from the industry. The markets watchdog said that despite bold targets and high-profile initiatives to boost the number of women in leading roles, there have only been pockets of progress. Overall, the picture is sobering. For all the rhetoric and conspicuous effort by some firms, the upper echelons of many financial services businesses remain as undiverse today as back in 2005. Many of the firms that have above-average diversity are signatories of the British Finance Ministry's Women in Finance Charter, but a recent update on the charter's progress suggests a shortage of senior women, particularly with backgrounds in technology and investment, could frustrate efforts to reach diversity objectives. Continued male domination of the sector was also deterring women entering financial services in the first place, and some firms don't want to feel obliged to hire a woman when a woman departs. Kate, what more can leaders do to ensure gender diversity rhetoric is actually turned into reality?
Well, this really is the difference between planning and action, isn't it? And we've commented before how press releases saying we've got these hugely ambitious targets for inclusion. And the question always is, well, tell us when you've done it rather than what you're going to do. So I think this, again, is real evidence of the intention isn't being delivered. And listeners will remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the broken rung. Maybe we've been spending too much time worrying about the glass ceiling, about getting people from middle to senior management positions, rather than setting them off on that journey much earlier. And I think that's where the attention should be. So you won't see huge gains in 1 year, but you should in five, and you certainly should in 10. So it's where you focus your resources. And of course, trying that much harder when you are recruiting for a vacancy. Don't go to the first agency you've always used. Don't go for the first sort of shortlist that you get. Say, if this shortlist lacks diversity, then there's something wrong with the recruitment agency. Go back, try harder.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story suggests that top athletes will do anything to win, and they'll put their morals and ethics aside when they step foot on the playing field. Researchers from the University of Birmingham in England and Sultan Qaboos University in Oman report that hard-nosed athletes naturally tend to suspend their sense of right and wrong when on the field, and are more likely to engage in antisocial behaviour for the sake of victory or to avoid punishment by their coaches. Reporting on the study, John Anderer notes that this tendency among athletes to put aside their morals on the playing field is described as bracketed morality, and coercive and controlling behaviour among coaches seems to be a significant predictor of immoral behaviour among athletes. The study cites practices such as controlling language, rewards and incentives being offered for strong performances, and even manipulating athletes' feelings and emotions as common practice amongst many coaches. This controlling behavior from coaches can in turn lead to athletes becoming morally disengaged and internally justifying acting antisocially and ruthlessly on the playing field. However, researchers are fairly certain that prolonged antisocial and negative remarks towards an athlete will virtually never result in improved play. Kate, does this put a different light on the Institute's recent research on sport?
I think it's a great piece because there's so much in here. At our Let's Talk Values conference last week at the University of South Wales, we heard from Professor Brendan Cropley, and he highlighted this problem of essentially what are competing values. If one of your values is to win and another is to act with integrity, well, sometimes winning might trump integrity, as this research is indicating. I think it also shines a spotlight on the behaviour of coaches and their role as role models. And if you are encouraging poor behaviour in pursuit of winning, well, that will impact your athletes. And then we have to remember how relatively short athletes' careers are and how some of them really struggle to adjust. That's a particular problem in the UK with professional footballers, how after their footballing careers, they struggle to adjust to normal life in normal jobs in normal organisations. And having been the victim, if you like, of these really poor practices, it's very likely that they're going to really struggle when they come to work in organisations which genuinely do live their values. So much to think about here. And I think the big question, I think, for us, as you've posed, is sport always a universal good, or can we be more critical in what we find out from research such as ours?
Thank you, Kate. Our final story is taken from the Wall Street Journal, and Lasse Reinigans realised taking time to check Facebook or respond to reply to emails distracted him from work goals and caused him to spend extra hours at the office rather than with his young daughters. So when he acquired a small tech consultancy firm in late 2017, he introduced a radical idea: reduce the workday to 5 hours from the standard 8 while leaving worker salaries and vacation time at the same levels. A quick question, Kate. Is a 5-hour workday sustainable?
Well, all the evidence would suggest that the length of the working day is reducing if the historical trend continues, and if we do embrace the benefits of increased automation. This is a short time period, isn't it? It's just been 2 years. And I think, yes, immediately you'll get a boost of enthusiasm and I won't waste any time. I'll be focused. And of course, it's easier to be focused for 5 hours than eight. But banning small talk or those sorts of office banter that we often talk about here at the Institute is a way of cementing the social relationships between people. And of course, we don't just come to work we come because we enjoy seeing our colleagues. We enjoy being part of something bigger. So much about work is good for our well-being and our mental health. So I think what I'm saying here, Rod, is that I'm ambivalent as to how sustainable these initiatives are and what you're trading off in the longer term when you try and cut out anything that just isn't about work.
And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thanks, Rod.